I would like to convene this meeting of the Lincoln County Board of Commissioners. Good morning. It is Wednesday, October 12th, 2016. All three commissioners are present, constituting a quorum. Our first up, a resolution proclaiming October 2016 as Domestic Violence Awareness Month in Lincoln County. And would our presenters come forward while I read that resolution? Whereas the crime of domestic violence violates an individual's privacy and dignity, security and humanity due to systematic use of physical, emotional, sexual, psychological, and economic control and/or abuse. And whereas domestic and sexual violence crosses all social groups, but people who are women, transgender, LGBTQ, poor or working class, native, of color, immigrant, non-English speaking, disabled, young, elderly, or otherwise marginalized not only shoulder the burdens of oppression, but also experience high rates of domestic violence. And whereas the impact of domestic violence is wide-ranging, directly affecting the health and wellness of individuals and society as a whole, here in this community, throughout the United States and the world, and whereas preventing interpersonal violence is not only possible, but is our collective responsibility, and prevention requires significant changes to our social norms regarding gender roles, strength, sexuality, relationships, and the normalization of violence, and whereas a coalition of organizations has emerged to directly confront this crisis, advocates and those involved with shelters and hotline services, law enforcement officials, healthcare providers, the clergy, and other concerned individuals are helping in the efforts to end domestic violence. Now, therefore, in recognition of the important work done by My Sister's Place, the Celeste Care Program, Lincoln County District Attorney, and the Lincoln County Domestic Violence Council, the members of the Lincoln County Board of Commissioners do hereby proclaim the month of October 2016 as Domestic Violence Awareness Month in Lincoln County. And we urge all citizens to work with these invaluable community agencies to help alleviate this problem in our community. Good morning. Welcome, everyone. Please introduce yourselves.
Yeah, so my name is Gillian Loesch. I'm the outreach coordinator at My Sister's Place.
My name is Kimberly Lane, and I'm the care program advocate for the Confederated Tribes of Celeste.
I'm Michelle Brandon with the DA's office.
Don Chapin from the Crossroads Batters Intervention Program.
Good morning.
So my program is based out of Celeste, but we do cover an 11 county service area, Lincoln County being one of them, and we participate on the Domestic Violence Council, the Sexual Assault Response Team, and we really are there to serve advocacy services to survivors of domestic and sexual violence, which means providing not just advocacy but also being a compass for resources, pointing them, in other words, in the right direction towards shelter, maybe grants or things like that from DHS. And we work very closely with My Sister's Place.
Yeah, so October every year, obviously, My Sister's Place observes Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and it's an opportunity for us to kind of focus on different dynamics of interpersonal violence and kind of have those conversations. And this year, we're focusing on the intersection of interpersonal violence and homes. So the idea that everybody deserves a safe, loving home or a sanctuary. So we're going about that this month in a couple of different ways. The first, and you kind of got a little packet there in front of you with some information, is that we're trying to raise what we're calling a sanctuary fund. So interpersonal violence is a leading cause of homelessness for women and children. 38% of people who've experienced interpersonal violence will become homeless at some point in their lives. And from a county perspective, the biggest issue that we face with a lot of our clients is, you know, if, once we get them to shelter or beyond, is then finding them a safe place to live afterwards. And it's no secret that finding safe, affordable housing here is a struggle. So as part of that, when our clients come to us oftentimes, you know, they'll say that I need help with, you know, I've got enough money for first and last month's rent, but I don't have, you know, the remaining money for my security deposit. Or I don't have enough money for the application fee, which is like $45 in most cases. Or I have bad credit, so my utilities, I need a deposit of $200. At the moment, My Sister's Place cannot provide direct rental assistance to any of our clients just from, you know, lack of resources. So we refer to other organizations in the county, and we're lucky enough to have some really great community partners. But at the moment, there's still a significant gap, you know, depending on the client, depending on their needs. when they come to us, it may not be a lot of money, but it is enough money that they might not be able to, you know, move someplace safe. Or we might get a client who calls and says, that, you know, my abuser is refusing to pay, you know, the rest of this month's rent, and if I don't have $200, we're going to be evicted. And then a lot of our clients, based on their abuse and the circumstances of it, may have trouble finding, you know, rentals from, you know, bad credit, bad rental histories, eviction notices, things like that. So we're hoping to raise, you know, enough money in the sanctuary fund. So all money, all private donation, personal donations that come into our organization this month are going to be automatically directed into that fund. As a way, so when clients call us, we can say, all right, if you need $45, we can help you with that. Or if you can come up with half of the security deposit, we might be able to help you with the rest. So in addition to this sanctuary fund, we're having what we're calling sanctuary nights. And we just had our first one yesterday in Newport. And it was a really fun and creative opportunity to kind of put together a physical representation of what safe home means to us in Lincoln County. So people came over, they made these, we're calling them fairy doors, and we put them on this big poster board. And on the inside, people were writing down, you know, what a safe home means to them. And it's kind of, it was very touching, it is very touching, you know, to look at what, you know, all of us who live in this community, what a safe home means to us. And some people might take it for granted, but for a lot of our clients, it can never take it for granted. The idea that you go home at the end of the night and, you know, you look forward to going home and you don't have to walk on eggshells or feel unsafe there. So our next sanctuary night is tonight in Lincoln City from 3 to 5 at the Community Center. And then we have one in Siletz on the 18th at the Siletz Community Center. And then at the end of the month on the 28th at the Yahas Commons. So we encourage everyone to attend. And in your little folders here, you've got a calendar of events, a poster about the sanctuary nights, and a little bit more information about our sanctuary fund. So I encourage everyone to donate if you can, or if not, to come out and show support at the sanctuary nights. And then, in addition to kind of creating safe homes through our clients, we've also, you know, we're working to make Lincoln County a safe home for everyone. And as part of that effort, we are really proud to announce a new grant in partnership with the DA's office. And I'll let Michelle talk about that.
So I can take over that a little bit. I wanted to take this opportunity in October to update the commissioners on domestic violence as I see it through our county. I know you guys are sort of on the periphery sometimes about what could be happening in our office as it pertains to particular cases. And I think I've mentioned to you in the past, and I just wanted to remind you, outside of DUIs, this is the largest number by volume of cases my office sees. And so we put a lot of our resources that you provide to us towards that. We have a full-time advocate for this position that is funded by the county. We have 1.5 deputy DAs that are dedicated to these kinds of cases, which obviously requires specialized training and commitment. And we have a really good team. Amber Colesrud is the lead on that. I have Lynn Howard and Casey Lewis as my deputy DAs that are also on that team. Susie Bear is our domestic violence advocate. They all do a terrific job. I have stats. I'm not going to bore you with the details, but I can tell you, like I said, by volume, we see the largest number of people through our office that have families that are affected by domestic violence. As Jillian mentioned, I'm proud. I feel even guilty announcing that there's a grant. I did very little to help attain the grant. My sister's place was the author. They were the ones running around trying to find people to collaborate to, with this. Lisa Norton carried the burden on this one, and we were all so grateful and stunned to see that she received it for Lincoln County. And by her efforts, they're going to be bringing in $475,000 as a contribution. Part of that is going to be an advocate for my sister's place. We were also awarded a position within the DA's office to be an investigator for domestic violence, sexual assault, and dating violence. And with the collaborative efforts of parole and probation, we're actually, and again, with Lisa Norton's efforts and her connection to these grant providers, they agreed, which is something I wasn't expecting, but they agreed to take a piece of that position that was dedicated to the DA's office and allow us to fund a probation officer, a position, a 0.25 position, so that we can get some of these misdemeanor offenders, which can be some of the most dangerous offenders we have in Lincoln County, supervised again. And I think at our meeting last year, Lauren Robertson gave a pretty impassioned dedication to a victim who, you know, thought she might actually lose her life that day, and that was from an offender that was on misdemeanor probation. And when we have these misdemeanors unsupervised running around with these conditions, victims initially can feel safe because the judge says, don't have contact with this person, don't go to the school, don't go to the grocery store where this person shops. but then there's really no one out there watching that has any kind of authority to help these folks out. With this grant, we are hopeful that we're going to be able to attain that, at least for 3 years and then maybe additional 3 years. So again, hats off to Lisa Norton for not only writing and securing the grant, but having enough of a good relationship with these grant funders to be able to change the grant at the last minute to help us really attain what I think Lincoln County is sorely missing. So I just want to mention that.
Can I ask you a question on that?
Sure.
So you say, I guess I need to have you deal with it more than anybody I know. So how many of these people that do get a judge to say cease contact?
Yep.
How many of the times is there a violation by the other person?
I don't,
percentage-wise.
Oh, man, it's got to be a high percentage. And sometimes offenders, they don't have the sophistication or education, and I've seen people violate that by sending flowers or depositing money, and everyone gets outraged by, what is that? But that's another form of control. And so I don't have the numbers. I can tell you that without tracking, I know the numbers would even be higher than what we could even report, because you know, my advocate, Susie Bear, tells me every day, she gets phone calls from victims who say, I've done everything. I've gotten a restraining order. This person is on probation, and they're still driving by my house. What do I do? And we keep saying, call the police, call the police. With our detective's position, we'll have somebody that can go out and check on that now. We'll have someone. Law enforcement is really strapped. They're thin. When they see that maybe somebody's not quite in danger, maybe that's not the number one call that they take. But this investigator can be the resource. Susie Gonzalez can provide a probation officer that would be able to say, this person is being tracked, and this violation is unacceptable, and we'll bring them back into domestic violence court. And Judge Bachart
wants it. That person's going to be very busy, is what you're
telling me. I think
they
will be, yeah. I think they will be. And again, Lincoln County, people are going to be safer when we've got eyes on these folks. These are a really... I've seen people skate through domestic violence probation when it's just bench probation. And Judge Bachart has said that on the record several times. You're a dangerous person because you know what to say, who to say it to, and when to say it. But then when you leave here, you know who to avoid and still be able to just do whatever you want and control and manipulate. And so when we've got eyes and ears on this person, it's going to make a big difference.
Okay.
Good morning. Thank you for your time this morning. As much effort as gets put into this initiative by my sister's place, by law enforcement, by the domestic violence court, by community justice, it is not any one of those one providers that makes a real difference. What makes a real difference is true coordinated efforts in our community. And we are fortunate in this county that the Board of Commissioners has been supportive, that the Board of Commissioners has had the compassion to recognize how grave this issue is and the courage to move forward to help support initiatives like this. It's that balance of compassion and courage, I think, that really moves these initiatives forward. We truly could not be making the kind of gains that we have been making in this county without the support of the commissioners, community justice, the Sheriff's Department, other law enforcement agencies, and my sister's place, the advocacy organization. It's extremely important that we address this issue. 1 million women and girls in the state of Oregon have experienced sexual assault and domestic violence. Our local numbers reflect that. And when we talk about safe home mm-hmm. initiatives, it's important, I think, for us to realize that oftentimes the most unsafe for women and girls is in their own homes. So we really do appreciate the support that we get from the commissioners and from all our community partners in moving this initiative forward. Our role as a Batterers Intervention Program is really to support those coordinated efforts. So I thank you for this time.
Thank you, Don, and thank you, everybody. And just let me say, I think this Sanctuary Fund concept is a great idea. You know, when I first started working on homelessness big time about 12 years ago, when it popped up, the link between domestic violence and homelessness, at first it surprised me, but then I realized it really shouldn't. You know, you hear so many times people on the sidelines who don't know the reality of a situation, they sometimes say, well, we know that woman's in an abusive situation. Why doesn't she leave? And there's, you know, there's a lot of dynamics involved there. But the fact that homelessness is the potential result is just one of those reasons. So I wish you much success with this and applaud that and applaud this ongoing collaboration and really what a strong team effort we're seeing on display here right now. Further comments or questions?
You said
I would echo Commissioner Hall's comments. I think it's a great, I'm pleased to see the type of cooperation and collaboration that's going on. I think we need more of this type of activity throughout the county, and I think you're great examples of what can be accomplished when we work together. I'm interested in, I think, Don, you mentioned that we're making progress. We're making progress. I guess I'm interested in where or how.
Oftentimes, jurisdictions get training in how to have more effective prosecution, how to have more effective law enforcement. And probably when it comes right down to it, the most effective increase we can have in prosecution and successful prosecutions and holding people accountable is when we have a more informed jury population. And I think that this county, over the last 20 years, close to 20 years that I've been involved here, has shown that it doesn't matter how many judges come and go, how many commissioners come and go, how many directors of the shelter, how many DAs come and go. That is, that's consistent push to have a more informed populace in the county. The more people understand the dynamics, that it's not always about the horrific physical and sexual acts that happen, that there are lots of other tactics that get used to keep people in a kind of one-down situation. So I think it's really the thing that's been most helpful is having a more informed jury pool, which means that the population is continuing to get further further informed about this issue in the first place. And we have some great partners. Community Justice has for the last, like I said, close to 20 years that I've been here, I think there's been three directors there, and all three directors, including the current one, have shown that they are willing to work together, not just to hold people accountable, but to increase the level of awareness in our county about this. So I don't know if that answers your question.
And I'd like to piggyback on that as well. And I think Don is spot on about the jury pool and educating folks on what it means to be in the cycle of violence. But beyond that, my sister's place has done an amazing job of working with my office. There's plenty of times where folks come into my office, they're victims, they maybe suffer from substance abuse or a history of domestic violence, and they're struggling just individually. And they have some kind of conflict with the way my office is approaching things, because our goal is to have accountability. And while we would love to have unlimited resources to look out for the victim's well-being, that is a secondary issue, because right now we need safety for this family. And so there's a lot of conflict sometimes between our victim's department and the victim. And my sister's place has been so collaborative and helpful. And I've been the DA for 2 years. I was never part of the management discussions before that. But what I see is a real coming together and a respect for one another's roles. My sister's place has a different role than the DA's office, and in the past I have not seen such collaboration as I have today. And again, as Don mentioned, PMP, they really do carry their end of the log. When they are able to, they help us make sure these folks are safe so we can get them into trial.
Michelle, since we're a terrorist community and we swell to a population almost three times as much, how many people wind up with domestic violence cases that are not from here that we deal with?
It'd be a ton. If I was putting a percentage on here, and I don't know if you guys are tracking these, it would be somewhere around 25%. We get so many people on vacation, their honeymoon, I can't, you know, spring break. I'm not even joking you. I have seen so, shocking, right? Come on vacation, leave on probation. That is not a stretch at all.
And so is there a way we can track that number? Because one of the things that really upsets me is when we see these numbers that come and says, well, Lincoln County has the highest number of people. Yeah, they're basing it on a population, not the true amount of people that we're dealing with here. So it seems like to track that number might give us a different foothold into what's the true number for Lincoln County instead of this.
I'll see if I can find that from my database.
Well, even if you can't, I mean, it's something that we might be able to just
start to generate
so that we show that we're not really as bad as some people in the Valley would like us to think we are.
And the other problem with that, just like our drug court, and I know you have a comment, but what I want to do is see our domestic violence court be able to make some real changes in our county. And I don't want to use a lot of resources for somebody going back to Portland or Seattle or wherever when, you know, what I'm trying to do is work on Lincoln County and make it safer. And so what I want is the folks that are going to be here in our domestic violence court here and have that person who's not going to be here using up our resources, which, you know, they're limited. So
for the last 4 years, Crossroads has, or at least 4 years, been tracking and monitoring those folks that are sentenced in, or go through domestic violence court. And so we do have to track everyone who's out of county as well as in county. It's an unfunded task that we do. It takes a great deal of time and effort. But I do believe that we could go back and at least get the number of those people who have been referred out of county.
That would be interesting.
Yeah,
it would be a
follow up on that.
Yeah, not that we're going to turn them down, but it's something we need to be able to say. This is what we're doing for the rest of the state, and maybe the rest of the state should be pitching in a little bit more for these type of areas.
I think that all areas, you know, whether it's corrections or whether it's law enforcement or whether it's my sister's place, it certainly would for offender programs, they're all underfunded. We're all working, doing things above and beyond. And just the fact that community justice is willing to participate in this latest initiative when they're underfunded and understaffed in the first place, I think is huge. So I think that as we work together, it would be important to separate some of those numbers about who is locally offending and who comes from out of state.
Well, and maybe from within the state. Maybe it's from one particular area. We can start to have a discussion in other arenas that might be able to help in the process.
One thing that I think is also important to keep in mind, though, that at the end of the day, though, the incidence rate for domestic violence is that 1 in 4 women will experience domestic violence in their lives. And at least at my sister's place, I'm sure it's similar at the care program, what we're seeing is that although we do have people that are coming from out of county potentially for shelter, and that usually happens when shelters are full and people are just calling down the lines to get someplace, that the majority of the people we serve are from the county. I mean, they may not have been, you know, born at the hospital here, but, you know, they live here for, and then they're residents. So I think one thing to keep in mind is that what we're dealing with, you know, is it's a problem for all counties everywhere, the whole state, the rest of the country. And it's not necessarily a question of whether or not Lincoln County is unique in the incidence rate of domestic violence so much as that we're very, very ununique. So I think these coordinated partnerships are definitely part of, you know, just attacking that problem many, many angles.
So, response. In your type of arena that you're dealing with, my sister's place, it doesn't surprise me you're seeing more. It's a little bit different question to them than it is to the DA, and I think that's something that's important that we understand, because the DA is dealing with the initial case, and a lot of those people, after they deal with the case, will go back where their home was, where they're not looking for shelter. They're dealing with the case here and then going back. And those kinds of things are important, because if we're really going to understand what's going on in Lincoln County, we've got to understand the whole big picture. And I agree with you. It doesn't surprise me, and I think you're right. That most of the shelter people would be local residents, but the number that they're dealing with may be considerably different.
And I always think that someone that's actually reporting domestic violence is very unlikely to ever do it again, especially if they have a bad experience in the system, their families in turmoil. You know, that's a real, you have that one opportunity, and whether they're in county or out of county, our department really takes that very seriously and understanding that this might be our only shot at intervention for these kids and this family.
I think sometimes, too, that people see the numbers in a county and they're confused. They think, boy, we've had this effort now for this amount of time. How come the numbers aren't going down? And really, if you have high numbers in your county, it may reflect that actually you're doing a better job because people are being referred back for smaller instances. The more informed the juror pool is, then the more likely they are to convict people for lesser crimes. The greater the understanding about the impact of sexual assault, domestic violence, stalking, teen dating violence, these things on our population, the more people are likely to report. So it's frustrating sometimes when the commissioners are looking at, wow, we're putting all this effort into this initiative and the numbers are going up. We would think that the numbers would be going down, but actually the more effective your community's response is, it's likely your numbers will increase.
I just wanted to second what Don said, because as someone who serves 11 counties, I do have to say that most of our calls and most of our relationships that we've established is here in Lincoln County, and I think that's because we do have this network, because those resources are getting out to the public, and because as community partners, we do a good job of referring. And so I know that for my program, that definitely reflects, because most of our numbers do come from Lincoln County, even though we cover a very vast population across basically the middle of Oregon and up the Central Coast.
All right, a very good discussion, very good ongoing education for all of us. I'd be ready to entertain a motion.
I move for approval of the resolution proclaiming October 2016 as Domestic Violence Awareness Month in Lincoln County. And it may be a lofty goal, but it would be nice someday not to have to do this.
Yeah.
Second.
Moved and seconded to proclaim October 2016 as Domestic Violence Awareness Month in Lincoln County. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next up is the adoption of the consent calendar, routine items or items that have been discussed at previous meetings. Are there any items that staff or commissioners wish to either highlight or remove from the consent calendar? Hearing none, I'd entertain a motion.
I'll move for approval of consent calendar.
Second.
Moved and seconded to approve today's consent calendar. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right. Next up, we have a public hearing. Amendment to the Lincoln County Comprehensive Plan and Zoning Map for the purpose of amending the City of Newport urban growth boundary and establishing a land exchange between two properties, one which is owned by Terrence Lettenmeyer and Lori Whitecamp, my apologies if I butchered those names, and the other owned by Fox and Bush, LLC, case file 01-LUP-ZC-16. Gentlemen, and while you're coming forward, I will run through. Do I need to read the entirety of this? Or do I? Yeah. Probably should for the record, right?
You could at least read the first part of it,
right?
Get down to the first paragraph.
Okay. So first, we will formally open this hearing. Then I will request if any commissioners wish to declare conflicts, abstentions, or ex parte contacts. This is the public hearing for case file number 1-LUPC-PC-16 to consider the recommendation from the Lincoln County Planning Commission to approve a request by applicants Terry Lettenmeyer and Lori Whitecamp for Terry Lettenmeyer and Lori A. Whitecamp for the following actions: an urban growth boundary amendment, a comprehensive plan amendment, a zoning map amendment, and a property line adjustment, which is an administrative action, all on two properties described as Assessor's Map 12-11-05, Tax Lot 801, owned by Lettenmeyer Whitecamp, and Tax Lot 100, owned by Fox and Bush, LLC. The purpose of the proposed actions is to facilitate the development of single-family dwellings on both properties as permitted under the Lincoln County Code. Gentlemen.
Commissioners, if I might, just the procedure here. What we'll do is you receive a staff report from the planning department. They'll talk a little bit about the history. This is a little more complicated. It's kind of, you're going to have to follow pretty closely here on this one. I know that I did in preparing some of the stuff that I had to do for this. But they'll describe specifically what's going to go on here. After the staff report comes in, you'll receive, this is a de novo proceeding, by the way, because it does involve a comprehensive plan map amendment and an urban growth boundary amendment. So you'll receive any testimony or evidence from the applicants, and then offer an opportunity for any opponents' testimony and evidence, and if there is any opponents, there will be an opportunity for rebuttal. At that point, we'll close the hearing, and the board can begin deliberations and reach a decision. So okay. With that, I'll turn it over to staff, and they can provide the staff report.
Please, Joshua, go ahead. Good morning, commissioners. My name is Joshua Shackley. I'm a senior planner with Lincoln County Planning and Development. I'm joined by our director, Anna Husing. Thank you for the opportunity to present the staff report to you this morning. So the applicant to these actions is, as was mentioned, Terry Lettenmeyer on behalf of his partner and owner of his property, Laurie Whitecamp, and the second property is owned by Fox & Bush LLC. Mr. Lettenmeyer was assisted in his application by attorney Chris Miner and land use consultant Don Pavitt. So it's to get where we need to be, it is rather convoluted, complicated process, but real when it comes down to it, it's really a simple matter of an exchange of 6 acres from one property to another, so a total of 12 acres are at play. But in order to accomplish that, we're it's necessary to go through an urban growth boundary amendment, a zone change, and a zoning map and comprehensive plan amendment. And ultimately, that will result in a property line adjustment between the two properties, which will exchange 6 acres from one property to the other and vice versa. So I'll refer to the exhibits here, and it should become more clear as I go through this. The property line adjustment is being processed administratively. It doesn't require a hearing. And again, the ultimate goal of the request is to facilitate a single-family dwelling on each property.
So say that again, Joshua. Just
sure.
The goal or the objective is
the goal of all these actions is to facilitate development of two single-family dwellings, one on each subject property. And hopefully it'll be more clear as I walk you through here. So the two properties we're talking about today, this is the Lettenmeyer-Whitecamp property. It is 71.39 acres in size. It's zoned rural residential 10 with a suburban residential comprehensive plan designation. Second property is owned by Fox & Bush LLC. It's currently zoned timber conservation, TC, and has a forest land comprehensive plan designation. So,
can I ask you one question now?
Sure.
Sure, I'm correct.
Sure.
Forest land would require 20 acres.
Minimum lot size of 80 acres.
80 acres. For residents. 80 acres.
So we're able to do
residency.
Right. We're able to do this even though this is under 80 acres because it's an exact exchange of 6 acres.
Apologize, I meant to say.
Sure.
The next.
So, just a little context on the properties. This is Southeast 98th Street. Thiel Creek runs parallel. There are some low-lying wetland areas and FEMA special flood hazard area that sort of follows the creek here. None of the development we're talking about today is subject to any of those. So you've seen what the properties look like now. This is what's proposed. The 6 acres currently on the Lettenmeyer-Whitecamp property will be exchanged to the Fox & Bush property. And these 6 acres here will be moved from Fox & Bush to the Lettenmeyer-Whitecamp. Again, in order to accomplish this, the urban growth boundary of City of Newport must be amended. Right now it follows this property line, and in order to accomplish this under Oregon Administrative Rule, UGB has to be amended. So The result is that both properties end up with the exact same acreage and zoning as they have now. So what's proposed is the 6 acres that's moving from the Lettenmeyer White Camp property is currently zoned RR10, but it will be rezoned to timber conservation and receive a forest land designation under our comp plan. And it is also being removed from the urban growth boundary of the city of Newport. This 6 acres is currently timber conservation, and it is to be rezoned rural residential 10, and it is being added into the urban growth boundary of the city of Newport. So the city of Newport approved the UGB amendment, the urban growth boundary amendment, in July of this year with ordinance 2101. A public hearing was held before the Lincoln County Planning Commission on August 8th, 2016. At that meeting, the Planning Commission voted unanimously to recommend to the Board of Commissioners to approve the actions before you today. On August 12th, findings, conclusion, and final order were approved and signed by the Planning Commission. So the charge of the board today is to determine whether the proposal meets statewide planning goal requirements for the UGB amendment and Lincoln County Code standards for a quasi-judicial amendment to the comprehensive plan and zoning map. Lincoln County Code section 1.1235 provides the following criteria for a quasi-judicial amendment to the comp plan and zoning map. The applicant must demonstrate that a substantial change in the character of the area has occurred since zoning was first adopted and which warrants the change of the zone. That's one criteria. The second, the zoning previously adopted in the area was in error. Third, there is a public need for the change being sought. So the applicant contends that a substantial change has occurred in the character of the area since the mid-70s when our zoning was first in place. And this contention is based on the fact that a number of residents are existing or have been approved on the properties. Just refer to... So there's an existing home here. Fox and Bush, as was mentioned earlier, is actually approved for a non-forest dwelling. And this is where the home site is to be located. Because it's zoned rural residential, the Lettenmeyer White Camp property is to be developed with a home site there. This property here has it's not a non-forest dwelling approval, but it is approved for a dwelling. There are numerous other scattered residences throughout the area. And within the city of Newport boundaries, you may be familiar with the Wolf Tree Destination Resort. So this is zoned for high density residential with a destination resort overlay. So the contention in the application is that based on these and other factors that a substantial change in the area has occurred, which warrants the zone change. So just briefly, I want to talk about the motivation behind the requests, and the applicant is here and may want to address these in more detail. But while the desired home site that I've pointed out there is able to be developed at this point without going through the property line adjustment and all these other actions, there are several reasons why that is a desirable location for the home site and why these actions would be necessary to develop it. And that's just a couple of those, a greater turnaround area for emergency vehicles and providing a buffer between, a forested buffer between the home site and the road and adjacent residences.
Josh, let me.
And I'm going to go ahead.
I want to ask a question. Looking at this, you're trading property that's equal amounts, and there's really no net change to the urban growth boundary. This looks like a no-brainer to me. Am I missing something that's... I mean, it just looks like a no...
The complexity of the actions that are necessary to make it happen.
Yeah, the complexity of the action, but I feel like I'm missing something here that's supposed to be earth-shaking.
No, you aren't missing anything.
Was there any opposition at the Planning Commission level?
No. We received no agency comments, and there was no testimony in opposition of the applications.
And was the Planning Commission vote to support all of this unanimous?
Okay, it was.
That tells us something.
The Planning Commission, they're the experts on it.
Mm-hmm. What about at the City of Newport's level? Opposition?
That you're aware of?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Okay.
they were able to move on it fairly quickly as well.
Okay.
So, and we did confer with our state agency, Department of Land and Conservation and Development, and no one at that level had a problem with it as well.
So, one of those little points, sort of things become like really clear with this topographic map here, because you'll see where the Lettermeyers really, this is a knob, you know, right? So it's a really high elevation place. It's an optimal home site for this otherwise very large property. So basically what you're dealing with here is the crest of a hill, and then you can see it drops steeply here, and that's why the additional turnaround area that ironically, with all this property that was in play, the optimal home site really was sort of crowded with this property line before, and the steep sided area, which would again the management of it would be.
I mean, that in the land use system, and I'm looking at the net change. I mean, whether it's on a hill or in a bottom, or that's not the issue, unless there's wetlands involved or something like that. It doesn't make any difference if it's on a hill or that or not. It's the net change in acreage, and yeah, without
and under the OAR, when we conferred with our colleagues at the state, there is a minor urban growth boundary amendment section to the OAR that speaks directly to this kind of a circumstance. Yeah. So it was, that's why the six and the six and the trade out.
Yeah.
But I think it's because you're messing with an urban growth boundary, you're messing with timber conservation, and that's why you have this labyrinth that one has to go through, because people will try to game the system and cut out rural home sites typically, unless there is this kind of, again, this labyrinth that really, really holds people accountable, that we're not, you know, trading away these resource lands and converting them to residential purposes.
All right, thank you, gentlemen. Are we ready? Can we bring the applicants forward for what they wanted to offer?
Yeah, I'm Terry Lettenmeyer. My wife and I are the applicants.
Okay.
And, thank you for considering this. I'll go through and explain a little bit what we're trying to do. I don't know if I have a ton to add. We also thought this was going to be simple in the beginning, but
well, not planning.
So appreciate getting to this point. So it's easiest for me to explain pointing out on this hillshade map what we're doing, though.
That's fine.
Put this up. So in the first place, we're jointly doing this with our neighbor Fox and Bush, but we're the ones pushing for this. They're following along. They're happy to do the exchange as long as we do all the work. So, we want to put a house right here, and the what's going on here is that, you know, way back, both these properties are owned by the same timber company. They're Boise Cascade at one time. And, you know, there's a lot of considerations here. We've got this, it's a great house site. It's got a nice southern exposure and so on. And also there's already roads in from the previous logging of the area. But the problem is that this little kind of finger that sticks out from the rest of the Fox and Bush property in here for us, there's minor advantages to us to getting this property, this ownership for this road turnaround. We also would like to put a little of our septic system on the south side of the property line. But and then there's also a little bit of an issue with the 50-foot setback from the timber conservation here. I think we could deal with all that okay without going through all this. But really, what we're really concerned about is the future logging of this little piece of land here. The problem is that this was last logged in 2002 and 2007. So it's quite a long time before probably get logged again. But since previously this had been jointly owned, and then for a while these folks here, Fox and Bush, had a temporary easement to use our property. Every time this has been logged in the past, it's been using access across our property. And they've used this site here as the landing for logging this area. So they no longer have access across our property. And since we're building the house here, we wouldn't want that access. But we just see all sorts of conflicts occurring at some point in the future when it's time for them to log again. The only access they have from the rest of their land is, you know, through this little narrow, very steep stretch between our place and this property at the bottom of the hill, the Sellage property. And the only relatively flat spot in this 6 acres that they could stage their logging operations from is right up here on the south side of where we want to build a house. And so we're just really nervous about that, and that's why we decided that we really want to go through this long process and do this exchange, especially since Fox and Bush is quite willing to do it. They're happy to accept this 6 acres here in exchange for this. So we see it a long process, but it's something that benefits everyone. This property, this 6 acres here, has a steep slope here, so we can't really access this from the rest of our property. This area over here is actually fairly flat or somewhat flat, but you have to go across the Fox and Bush property to access it, and we don't have access that way. So all around, it's a good exchange for the both of us. In terms of justifying this change, we feel that, you know, originally these were both timber conservation land, and then in the late 1980s, our land became residentially zoned for the Wolf Tree Resort, and then we've done another change since to make it R10 zoning so we could de-annex it in the city so we could build a house there. But this change from timber conservation in the late 1980s to our property, and then also this house here, zoned by the Selges at the bottom of the hill, was built in 1979. That both occurred since the zoning was first in place. So this thing with this little piece of timber conservation land in between two residential pieces of property, is we think that's the significant change in the character of the area that's happened since zoning was first introduced.
Okay, any questions from the Board of Commissioners? Thank you for the information.
Thank you. Pretty straightforward.
Is there any opposition testimony to this request? Hearing none, there's no need for a rebuttal. So at this point, we can close the hearing and begin board deliberations and discussion.
I said it, this is an equal trade. The timber company didn't do it unless they thought there was an equal trade, mm-hmm. and it isn't officially changing anything in the zoning laws. This one should go.
Both parties are agreeable to it.
Okay.
Makes sense.
I agree. Mr. Belmont,
Commissioners, if you'd like, I've actually drafted up an ordinance that you could adopt today since you've held the public hearing and there was no opposition.
Okay.
And what I need to do procedurally.
That's item A2 on the agenda.
Yeah, A2. Okay. But would you pull the actual copy that's in your materials in there? And I'd ask first, is there a request by any of the commissioners that you want to be read in full?
No.
Hearing none, then. Chair, you can read it by title only. If you don't have a copy, you got it.
No, I do. Ordinance 489. Amendment to the Lincoln County Comprehensive Plan map and zoning map for the purpose of amending the City of Newport urban growth boundary and enabling a land exchange between two properties, one which owned by Terrence Lettenmeyer and Laurie Whitecamp, and the other owned by Fox and Bush LLC. Case file 301-LUPC-ZC-16. Oh, okay. We'll correct that. Yeah. And declaring an emergency. Is there a motion to adopt Ordinance 489?
I make a motion to adopt.
I'll second it.
Any further discussion? Moved and seconded to adopt Ordinance 489. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. So ordered. Okay, next up, we've got one...
Make a comment.
Yes?
The land use system is very complicated.
Yes, it is.
And it's very complicated. It's seldom that we see something like this. It's so straightforward, and they're all parties agree. And this is unusual.
Very good.
Okay. Thanks for the job you guys did.
Next up, renaming of the old Highway 20 to Crystal Creek Loop, and I guess this couldn't be more timely since the new Highway 20 opened yesterday. Mr. Belmont, Mr. Kenyon.
Commissioners, what you have before you today is some of the continuing activities that need to take place for completion, full completion of the Highway 20 project, Eddie Ville to Pioneer Mountain Loop. As you may recall, part of the arrangement that we made for Highway 20 being improved was that what we'll call for the time being old Highway 20 will be transferred. The board entered into an agreement a number of years ago, actually, to accept old Highway 20 into the county road system. We've done this before in other properties when other improvements have been made to state highways, so this won't be the first time. And we actually have several little bits of old Highway 20 in the county road system as other improvements over the years have been made. So that agreement will be coming to you, actually an amendment to that agreement will be coming to you in the not too distant future to finalize the transfer of that road to us. But in addition to doing that, we have to rename the road. Obviously, the new portion of the road will continue as Highway 20, and that will be part of the state highway system. But the old portion needs to be renamed. And under our county code provisions dealing with naming, we can't, you know, we need to have road names that are not the same or similar to other roads in the county system. So,
can I interject there, Mr. Belmont? So I think the question from some in the public might be, why don't we simply call it Old Highway 20?
Right.
And that's the reason.
And that's the reason
why. And that provision exists to hopefully to minimize confusion for first responders, among other things.
Absolutely.
Well, and I might clarify, too, since the subject's been brought up, but, you know, the question might be, well, why don't you call it Eddyville Loop or Chitwood Loop? And, again, it has to do with the hierarchy of the, whether it's a road, a loop, a court, whatever, and because of that hierarchy in naming, those alternatives were also eliminated.
Yeah, we had to vet those, and so we have those names. We already have names such as Eddyville, Chitwood, Pioneer Mountain, Yaquina. Those are names that are, you know, you might think might apply to this, but we already have in the county road system have roads by that, those names. So,
well, let me explain something.
You want to explain Crystal Creek?
Yeah,
Crystal
Creek.
People may wonder where that name came from.
First of all, ODOT told us they wanted a name a long time ago, and at that point we didn't have anything to move on, and so it was the commissioner's decision at that point, and we went out and searched for names, and it's an experience I don't want to repeat too often. It's not easy to get three commissioners to agree on anything that has a name involved. Interestingly, that was Crystal Creek Loop was the one that rose to the top, because we kept coming up with names, but every time we wound up having problems with another road or another area that could have been confused. And since the new highway had Crystal Creek coming through it, and that was access to it, that was the name that was finally decided on by all of us. Even though Muddy River had real potential.
Well, commissioners, this is the formal process for naming it. Now we have to go through the addressing system to name that. So that's what's being proposed as the name is Crystal Creek Loop. And the way this works under the county code, we no longer have an addressing department, so we've had to modify things a little bit, run it through the road department, the surveyor's office, and the assessor's office have assisted us. But what we would do to formally name this as Crystal Creek Loop is for you to adopt an order which proposes that particular name. Then we will send out a notice there. This is a fairly, obviously, it's a 7.7 mile, help me if I got the distances right, 7.7 mile area in which there's a number of properties, addressed along that particular area. And we will provide a written notice to all the parties that either own property or residents along that area, and that's created some of its own deals that we've had to, in order to make sure we're getting adequately covering everybody. We're going to send a notice to them about this proposed name. That's what we do under the code. And then the parties there do actually have an opportunity to raise questions or objections to you of that name. If they do so, then we will schedule a public hearing on this particular name change, and we'll then at that point, after the public hearing, you will make the final decision on what the name of the road will be.
Question, Mr. Belmont, is there any threshold for a public hearing? I mean, if one person objects, are we required to hold one, or is there some?
The code is unclear, but I would tell you right now, if you have an objection, it says an objection. So okay. If there's an objection, we'll hold a public hearing.
Okay.
But in addition, I think it's going to be a good idea to hold a hearing because obviously what's going to happen as an end result, no matter what name is chosen here, is there will be changes in the addresses of all the folks out there. One of the things when it comes into the county road system, and I'm going to let Mr. Kenyon explain the actual process and how we arrive at the numbering system, but we're going to have to change. So the numbers on the properties will change based on whatever on the name of the road is here. So it'll be XYZ or 123 Crystal Creek Loop.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a system that's in place for actually providing those names, and since this road has changed, we're going to have to do that. And there may be some questions also, and I know there's been some. We've been in contact with the first responders and dispatch about this issue, and we'll have more discussion about, they need to know specifically where to dispatch to, not only along that road, but also along the new section of Highway 20, and that creates its own headaches, because that system's been changed now over the years, and when you see certain mileposts, for instance, they don't jibe. What's the milepost? Why it doesn't start from ground zero and be renamed all the way through.
Can I make a comment?
Sure.
This is the littlest problem of Highway 20 they've faced over the years.
It is, but I think but
it's a real one.
It's a real one, especially first responders. They're concerned about that, and so we want to make sure we get that all together. But I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Kenyon to explain the process for how they determine now the numbering system and how that will work.
I'm Roy Kenyon, Public Works Director for Lincoln County. Typically, when we inherit these sections of road, when they are a loop road, meaning there's an entry on either end of it, we milepost the road north to south or west to east. And so in this case, the road runs more or less west to east. And so milepost 00 will be at the west intersection with the new Highway 20 alignment, running east towards Eddyville. What the county will do is they will measure out the road and install mile markers along the length of what's going to be the new county road.
Roy,
yes?
They're going to do from west to east on Highway 20 so that we... Do you know?
I do not know.
Well, I can address that. The question has been raised at the ACT, where I serve as vice chair. ODOT is looking into it. It's not as simple as it sounds because of the GPS, the addressing, and a variety of issues, but ODOT is looking into that possibility.
But they don't have any addressing on the new Highway 20 alignment because there was no...
Well, you're talking about the new milepost starting at Highway 101 is zero, and correcting it all the way through.
I see.
Are they going to do that? They're going to correct it?
They're looking at it. It's expensive. Well,
and of course, remember what happens is when you change those mile marks too, that means every mile mark beyond here for Highway 20 that goes to the border of Idaho and beyond.
But they start over at zero in Benton County.
Yeah, they may start again at zero in Benton County.
There are inconsistencies now. I've told the story when I first moved here. I was watching the mile signs, and all of a sudden, what happened those last 3 miles? I go, must have missed something. Oh, no, I didn't miss something. They aren't there. So the current highway has problems with that, regardless of the new alignment.
Sure. Yes, it does.
Okay.
So Anyway, yeah, we will measure the road, we will set the mileposts, and then we will actually measure the entrance to every residence along that line, and the address will coincide with the mileage. So if you happen to live right at the 1 mile marker, your address would be 1000 Crystal Creek Loop, or whatever road number name is decided.
So given the number of properties and residences that are involved with this thing, I think having a meeting with the folks, explaining that system, making sure they understand that, you know, we're going to be doing something like that anyway, whether we have a public hearing or not, just to get that information out to everybody.
Right, and you have to understand this. We're not breaking new ground with this.
No.
This has been done over and over again.
Yeah.
You know, we have accepted multiple loops and dead-end roads from the state. Up and down 101, 229, now, you know, Highway 20. Hopefully this is the last one on Highway 20. I don't know where else they'd go, but
you're right. All right, so if we want to move this process forward, again, Mr. Belmont, what we need to do?
An order that would initiate it. Once you adopt the order, that will trigger a process in which we have to get the written notice out to the residents and property owners out there within 10 days.
This was a discussion item, so should we schedule that for action next week?
I think I would appreciate that.
Yeah.
And we can put together all our mailing lists and the letters.
All right. We'll do that. Thank you, gentlemen. Okay, now we move on to reports, and first up is a report from Treasurer Linda Pilsen on Loan Preservation Assistance Program. And I believe this handout you gave us is related to this. Okay.
Linda Pilsen, Treasurer and Tax Collector, and this is a program that I'm really excited about for both departments. It's the program is the Oregon Homeowners Stabilization Initiative, and it was created to administer the and expand the U.S. Treasury's hard-hit funds. And the intent is to assist homeowners to prevent them from going into foreclosure, if they qualify. And on the top portion of that flyer that you received, it has their qualifications. They have to be able to prove that they can pay their taxes going forward. It has to be a primary residence, and the property value cannot exceed $625,000, and their income is no more than 120%. It can't exceed 100% of the poverty level. So with this, if they qualify, they would receive up to $40,000 interest-free, five-year forgivable loan. So if they took out a loan of $20,000 to pay their back taxes to stop foreclosure, then it would be 20% a year they would be forgiven, so it would be $4,000 a year. So at the end of that five-year period, they would owe nothing on this loan. And one good thing, they're offering it to the rural counties first. It's a federal grant, and they're offering it to the rural counties first before the larger counties. And they were going to roll it out to the Central Oregon coast on October 5th. But they weren't able to get their website revisions completed. So November 16th is the date that it's going to, that's their target date. The OHSI, they work directly with the homeowner. The county is not responsible for any marketing, advertising, anything to that nature, even though it would behoove us, because we work with the taxpayers on a regular basis, we know who possibly could use the help. So they do have flyers. That bottom portion of the paper is a mail insert, which I would consider mailing that out with our delinquency notices.
That sure makes sense. And I assume they're going to then handle kind of a marketing effort to agencies that would likely be working with people in
right.
a property tax distress situation.
Correct.
Okay.
And the county is basically the recipient of the money. There is a memorandum of understanding, mm-hmm. which Wayne wasn't real excited about to begin with, but he took it on, and now it's
okay.
He's comfort. He's got his comfort level. And so basically what it is the county and the tax collector, we do this anyway, our department. We give information on taxpayers' delinquencies to a number of escrow agencies and mortgage companies.
So this is one more resource for people.
It is one more resource, and they would be able to, we have to be able to accept electronic payment and post timely. And the one other benefit is to this, that is if for some reason, let's say the borrower becomes ineligible for the program, the county is not responsible for paying back any taxes received. Not like the DOR program where we have to pay tax plus interest. So it looks, we haven't began the program. We know of taxpayers that it would hopefully benefit. And so hopefully next time I can come back and tell you how great it's going.
Okay. Any other questions for Linda?
Just to clarify, so if a property owner takes advantage of this opportunity, the county gets the money in bulk, if you will, for the delinquent taxes, and then the loan that the property owner has through the program is forgiven at 20% a year over the five-year term.
That's correct.
So, okay.
Excellent.
Good and program. If you go to the website, it has a frequently asked questions. It's not fully up and running. They will have all their forms and all of their information out there eventually. But the person, the taxpayer homeowner, can go out and look at those and a phone number to call for information.
It's funded through the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
And Commissioners, in case it wasn't clear, this is actually the program itself is administered by the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. So it's actually a state program with federal money. And then this, the OHSI is the initiative they're doing here. So.
Okay. Thanks very much. Commissioner reports.
I spent the last couple days working with marine technology in the maritime industry. It was an interesting couple days talking about it because, you know, Newport's moving forward in this whole area. It was a good conference. It was, I had a lot of high school kids there from Lincoln County.
Excellent.
And I was surprised that knowledgeable of what they were doing in some of our high school, Walport High School. I got a chance to talk to some of the students there and was impressed by what their science program, and it, a lot of it came from the STEM program apparently, and I hadn't been exposed that much to STEM because I haven't had a student in the system in a while, but it was educational for me in a lot of areas, including what our local kids are able to do with the STEM program.
Great. Commissioner Hunt?
On my report, I attended the three-day conference at Salishan for the Oregon Emergency Management System, and had the opportunity to recognize one of our own county employees, and forgive me, Kay, but I believe your last name is Myers.
Wyatt.
Thank you. Kay Wyatt. I apologize, Kay. But anyhow, the opportunity to recognize Kay Wyatt as the Oregon Volunteer of the Year. So she was recognized as the outstanding volunteer in the entire state. And we had heard from Kay before the Board of Commissioners when she talked about her involvement in CERT, which is the Community Emergency
Response
Team. Thank you. So again, it was a good program. Also, I had the opportunity to hear retired General Russell Honoré, and many of you may recognize that name. He was the individual that took over the Katrina disaster recovery when it was really in a state of total chaos. So, and a very powerful and motivating speaker, an interesting gentleman. So, but also an opportunity to learn more about being better prepared when a disaster strikes.
Excellent. Okay. I'm going to pass today. We'll move on to constituent input. Up to 5 minutes on any subject.
Good morning, commissioners.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So it's been a while since I've been here, but I've actually been keeping close contact and watching you guys. And I watched your meeting last week and your proposal to change the rules on the cannabis grow sites. I'm glad that you want to respect your planning department with, as I listened to Mr. Thompson say, that that is their job. And but yet, when we came to you last year, we asked that that CT zone, that commercial tourist zone, be reconsidered on having a dispensary. You changed the rules in South Beach. You allowed a dispensary to be within 1,000 feet of a state park, but you refused to follow your planning department's or your commission's suggestions to accept CT as a dispensary. So that's pretty sad, and now you're going to go ahead and change the rules again for a few people, because you've acknowledged that it's only going to affect a few people's land. I wonder who they are. And yet you still are pursuing a lawsuit against us. I was talked with our attorney on Monday, and I was told that this could drag out for a year. And this is a really sad day for me, because I'm sitting in some deplorable conditions myself personally. I'm glad you're focused on homelessness, because you may be trying to help me soon. And yet, I'm being drained with legal fees. Every dime that we've put into that facility and the very little profit that's come out of it has gone to lawyers' pockets. So I thought I'd bring that up. I also wanted to bring some fact into here, because it's sad that I sat and I listened, and I listened to, and, you know, I'm really hoping, I wish we could work together, but that doesn't ever seem to be the case. So Jackson County, you brought up Jackson County last week, and you mentioned that there was some horrendous amount of growers down there. And actually, I pulled the statistics up this morning. And in Jackson County alone, they have 9,234 patients. There's only 73,000 OMMP patients in the state of Oregon, but that's up just in the last year from 68,000 last year. So we're seeing more and more people that are understanding how this medicine works. They're choosing to go and use this medication once they found out that it actually is effective. So you're seeing an increase in the patient count. But we still, Jackson County did have a LUBA decision. I've been very close contact. I actually attended the LUBA hearing in Jackson County. And what they're now doing is they're shutting down outdoor grows. And I appreciate the fact that you guys want to make that opportunity available on smaller properties. You understand the energy costs. But we're down here in Jackson County violating growers that have been doing this for 17 years. There's a grower in Medford right now that grows for nothing but disabled veterans. And they're now facing a $250 a day fine. And Mr. Thompson, I wish you wouldn't ignore me and stare off at your paper, because I really, really was hoping that of all people, you're starting to understand the issues of our community. Okay, I'm not here to be confrontational or anything. I really want to get this stuff out into the open. So, and that's been the problem with the legislature and everybody. We have hundreds of people that travel to Salem. They go before the state legislature, and they're given 2 minutes to tell their life story, and they cut them off. And yet the lobbyists get all the time they want, including Mr. Rob Bovat. So one of the things I wanted to bring forward also is the update on the legislature and how it's affecting us as a dispensary. They just adopted a rule October 1st that 100% of the medications in a medical dispensary has to be tested for pesticides. Okay? But the OLCC regulated dispensaries are only required random pesticide testing. Now, the lab that wrote their legislators or submitted their testimony said, we don't want to harm the public. We want to make sure this product is safe. We have to test 100% of this medicine. But when the OLCC decided they're going to do random testing, they didn't care about the public's health. They want to make sure that that medical is tested 100% for pesticide. What that has done, there's one lab. There's actually two that are accredited for ORLAP testing. One of them is in the process of moving, and that's OG Analytical. So they're not taking any tests. So we've got Greenleaf Lab in Portland that is accepting 100% of the medical testing for pesticides. And we're in the middle of a harvest. In Southern Oregon, we got 2,000 growers that are producing down there medicine, and they can't get the stuff tested. So what this legislature has done with their beautiful ideas and their implementing these rules that they didn't think first how it's going to affect, I'm going to guarantee you there's going to be an illegal market that's going to blossom because there's no way to get it into a dispensary. They will not allow it in a dispensary, and they can't get it tested. So what they've done is they mandated rules, and now they've done exactly gone against their own mandate. Now, Rob Bovet, last year, he went before the state legislature, and he told them, he said, there's one thing that the Oregon voter had the right to do. He says, if you force me to push the federal button, and he sat there and he threatened the Oregon state legislature. I pulled it up. I put it on my Facebook page because I remembered it. And he said, if you don't allow us the opt-out, which you guys all use beautifully, he said, what you're going to do is you're going to force me because this is the Rob Bovet employment bill. Measure 91, he called it. Rob Bovet employment bill right before the legislature. And he said, what you're going to do is you're going to force me to take this.
7 minutes.
You're going to force me to take this to federal court. And what you're going to be left with is total decriminalization in the state of Oregon. Because that's the only thing this law could have done. Was either legalize cannabis or not. And we're all at the point now. I understand that, sir, but you know what? These are important issues, and I really wish you would give me the time to explain this situation. Okay? It's sad because I sat here through an hour of reports on battered women. What do you think the stress that you put people through, the poverty, okay? So anyway.
We need to be fair to all constituents. Yeah.
And consistent.
So am I cut off?
Your time is concluded.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Well, I want to make sure that you guys all get a copy of the letter that I've served on the state legislature in regards to these issues. And like I said, I really hope that you would consider the CT zoning again, consider putting that also before the zoning, the planning department again, along
okay,
with the zone changes.
And we will accept this into the record. Thank you. Are we in need of an executive session today?
No, Commissioner.
Oh, I should have asked, is there any other constituent input? Okay.
Might take a moment to recognize our new Director of Personnel and Resources. Michael, you want to stand up and say a word or two? Come to the
and
microphone.
If you are going
to
say a word or two, please come to the microphone.
Good morning, Commissioners. I want to thank you all for taking me on. I'm having, it's been fun so far and interesting. I'm looking forward to it. I have to say that the reception that I've gotten from everybody across the board has been very warm and informative. We've got a lot of work ahead of us, I can see that, but I think we've got the will to do it, and we're going to take it on and get the job done for you. So thank you very much.
Thank you and welcome.
For the record, I think I've been doing a horrible job too. This is Mike Herford. We always say our new personnel director and forget to say his name.
Okay. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
Well, all right. Our next meeting is 1 week from today, 9:30, at this same time and location. Till then, we're adjourned.